What I want to do is tell you about a few of the biological structures and processes that inspired many of us to think about electrostatics, even though those same people who were inspired to get into this field because of biology haven't yet gotten to biology. It's very significant that we have in the backs of our minds some rather spectacular molecules and structures and processes that arise naturally in biology. So I want to tell you a little about the DNA molecule and its relevance to electrostatics problems. DNA on a certain length scale looks like a rigid rod, and a larger length scale is a flexible linear polymer. It's negatively charged, arguably the most important molecule in any context. Another object that's arguably as important as anything else is the cell membrane. It's not a single molecule. It happens to be a two-molecule thick layer. So I'll just depict that here as a planar membrane. Of course, on larger length scales, it's not planar. I'm going to talk about bilayer membranes that are positively charged. And I'm going to talk about interesting complexes formed between objects like this and objects like this. The only other geometry left to talk about is the globular one, or sphere. And proteins, of course, aren't spherical objects. But there are many globular proteins that can be well approximated by spheres. There are many of them that are highly charged, many of them that are positively charged. I'll tell you about a very important example of a positively charged globular protein, and we'll talk about how it complexes with DNA. So part of what I'll do is tell you some basic facts and properties about these biological objects and comment on their relevance to formulating unsolved problems in electrostatics. Our workshop isn't about a particular phenomenon. It's about many phenomena and many different kinds of theoretical approaches to those phenomena. One idea I want to talk about is an idea that is already contained in the mean field theory of ions in solution, the Poisson-Boltzmann theory. It's like the Hartree theory of electronic structure. And I will take a little time to introduce the Poisson-Boltzmann theory, not in a rigorous way, in a suggestive way, and talk about some highly non-trivial phenomena, namely counter-ion condensation, that are contained in that theory, and then talk about effects related to counter-ion condensation, namely charge renormalization of highly charged objects in solution. It's related to charge compensation. And then there's the possibility of overcompensation, where you actually change the sign of a charged object because of counter-ion condensation effects. When an object like this complexes with an object like this, the question is, how much of this chain will adsorb around the ball, enough to neutralize the charge, or possibly even change the sign of the charge? That's something that many of us have been thinking about and referring to as overcharging, but it's obviously related to charge renormalization and compensation associated with counter-ion condensation effects. So that's what I'm going to talk about. I realize I haven't been yet to a seminar that's an hour seminar in my 5-6 weeks here, but I've been to many great seminars. I'll try to stop in an hour, and I hope there'll be the usual interruptions. Because it's a blackboard talk, I can't show you beautiful pictures as I would if I had an overhead projector. And it's beautiful pictures that certainly got me thinking about electrostatics, because I saw pictures of what DNA does in solution and how DNA complexes with proteins and membranes. These were electron micrographs, and they were spectacularly beautiful. You'll have to tolerate my bad drawings. I did bring one beautiful thing. That's part of the double helix. And it's not just a model. This was borrowed from a colleague of mine at UCLA, Dick Dickerson, who about 20 years ago, when he was at Caltech, after many years of tough X-ray determinations on important proteins, he tackled the job of getting high-resolution DNA X-ray structure. Many people mistakenly think that there was good X-ray data in the early 1950s available for Watson and Crick to work out this structural model. Fact is that there was no single crystal of DNA, so you couldn't do the usual high-resolution X-ray work. You had pulled fibers of DNA. So it was very significant that almost 30 years after the structure of DNA was, quote, determined, it was determined for the first time in a single crystal X-ray experiment. And what it took was for people to be able to make short enough, pure enough pieces of DNA so that they could grow single crystals to get high-resolution X-ray data. So this is an oligomer. I don't remember whether it was a dozen or 15 base pairs involved in the original determination by Dickerson. I don't remember what the base pair sequence is, but the significant thing is that with much better resolution, all the conclusions from 30 years ago were confirmed. So it's pretty to look at, even if you didn't know that this was the molecule, and that this is an atomic scale fact about it. What I want to point out, of course, there's so much to point out. There's what's called the major groove, the minor groove, there's the double helix. There are the heterogeneous aromatic rings, the carbon-nitrogen rings. Carbon is black, nitrogen is blue. These are the famous bases that get paired through hydrogen bonding and then stack again through hydrogen bonding interactions. And it's those interactions that give rise to the double helix. The yellow and red groups are the phosphate groups. And then these guys are the sugars. And those are basically the components of DNA. What's significant for our purposes are the phosphate groups, because you see that this is clearly, this is PO4 minus, so this is a highly charged object. Of course, what's more significant for us is all the genetic information carried in this sequence of base pairs. So our lives depend, literally, on all these details. But from now on, for our purposes, we suppress all of that biologically important life-sustaining detail. And we start thinking about DNA like this. Okay? Now, the fact is that several people at the workshop have taken some steps beyond this and worried about the fact that you have a helix and what that does to basic interactions between different strands or different parts of the same strand. So, how are we going to think about the DNA chain. We'll refer to a width of the tube, which is about, well, the diameter is about 20 angstroms. The distance between charges, I'm not drawing this to scale, we'll call that B, and B is about 1.7 angstroms. So the linear charge density is minus E per 1.7 angstroms. Since you have a radius, you can go from a linear charge density to a surface charge density. That's going to be minus E over 2 pi AB. And it turns out, with these numbers I've given you, that this is of order one charge per 100 square angstroms. And this will be significant because when I tell you what typical charge densities are on membranes, we'll see that they're comparable. What other structural properties are we interested in? Well, there is a persistence length, and it's largely due to the double helix. It's hard to bend the DNA chain because you'll disrupt the base pair stacking and destroy the double helix. Of course, it's a highly charged chain, so you also have electrostatic contributions to the persistence for the bendability. This is of order 500 angstroms.
How is that precisely defined?
It isn't precisely defined. I mean, in a worm-like chain model, you could argue that it's how far down the chain you can go before you get a significant deviation in direction. But it doesn't have to be precisely defined. Indeed, it'll depend on what we're applying the idea
because
to.
Different numbers are quoted because different people use.
That's right. Yes, and for sure, you add salt, you can change it. I'm just trying to compare some very discrepant length scales. Finally, the contour length. Contour length can be as small as, it can be anything. You saw it can be a few, a dozen base pairs. But typically the DNAs one works with are, say, starting about 500 angstroms. Rudy mentioned a few times in his presentations to us that a nice way to get a piece of DNA about this size is to take chromatin, chromosomal material, and digest with enzymes the DNA that isn't strongly absorbed to the globular proteins. I'm going to talk about that in a little more detail in a moment. It happens that you can very nicely get pieces of DNA that are 146, not 147, not 145, but 146 base pairs long, taking advantage of a special way DNA organizes in chromosomes. And the distance between base pairs is about 3.5 angstroms. So you go from here to another favorite length is, it must be about 150,000 angstroms because it corresponds to 48,000 base pairs, such as you have in the DNA in a very particular virus capsid, lambda phage DNA. So that's a favorite DNA. It's the contour length. It's the contour length along the main axis. Okay? And then human DNA is on the order of, it's up to meters. So we go up to meters. That's the genome for a big animal.
And it's so the 20 angstroms is
Yes. 20 angstroms is the diameter, and L, the contour length, would be the height. Okay? Okay, now remember the persistence length, and that's why I wasn't too particular about it. If I have something this long, this is tens of microns long, you know what DNA looks like? It looks like this. It behaves like a flexible coil with a radius of gyration or Flory size, say radius of gyration of about a micron. So on this scale, the persistence length is just a little straight portion of the chain. I'm not going to say anything about the very interesting interactions between DNA strands, which can be strongly repulsive or weakly attractive with many important consequences. Many of us are interested in those things, but I'm going to just mention one fact about how a chain like this behaves in solution and its relevance to biology and therefore the importance of understanding the physical process.
Before you go on, protein structure we know is important for the function of your protein. Is the structure of this mass important for
its... this mass, no, but DNA is not organized that way in biological systems. It's organized many other ways, which I'll talk about. And then the argument is that indeed it's the physical properties of this thing condensed in a special way that's important biologically. Have I understood the sense of your question? Again, I hope you'll forgive me for getting personal, but and I hope you'll forgive me for not really telling you something personal now, but I'm just going to tell you the experiment that I couldn't get off my mind and which got me started thinking about all these problems. It's an in vitro, well-controlled lab experiment with take a very dilute solution of DNA. So it might be that kind of DNA, it might be this kind of DNA. But take a very dilute solution, so it's, just in case this means something to you, it's as dilute as micrograms of DNA per milliliter of water. And there's some salt in there. But that's not important. It turns out that there's any of a large number of things you can add to this solution to get the DNA to condense into a very special structure. A scale drawing of what happens when you add, for example, trivalent cations, small ions with a charge of three or more. And it doesn't matter which of many you add. You can add low molecular weight uncharged polymer like polyethylene oxide. You can add low molecular weight charged polymer, polylysine, polyamino acids. You can do something as simple as just add a little bit of solvent that isn't good for DNA, isn't as good as water, like methanol or ethanol. In any of those cases, what you find is that this ramified structure, this flexible coil, condenses. Here's the scale drawing of what it condenses to, and now I'll show you that it condenses in a large number of cases to a donut. And I'll put the donut out here because I can't draw it very well. This is circumferentially wound DNA. So, what are the dimensions? And I'm telling you universal dimensions. The remarkable thing is that it doesn't matter whether you take this molecular weight DNA or this molecular weight DNA. I'm exaggerating a bit, you always get the same condensate. It's a torus with the same dimensions. This radius is about 500 angstroms. This approximately circular cross-sectional radius is about 100 angstroms. And if you look at a cross-section, since it's circumferentially wound DNA, basically what you've added are condensing agents, which for various very interesting reasons make the DNA attract each other, itself or each other, depending upon whether there are many strands going into this structure, head to tail, or whether there's a single one. It turns out that the amount of DNA in here is about 50,000 base pairs. Question?
It wasn't obvious you have enough volume for a millimeter of length.
Yes, you don't. I'm sorry. Now, we have a universal result that applies over a limited range. But it's an impressive range. It's a factor of 100 range. And it turns out that the amount of DNA in here is indeed about 50,000 base pairs. It can be some more. So when you take low molecular weight DNA, you have an aggregation process as well as a condensation, whereas here it's a collapse process.
And those are lying around a large radius?
Yes. So the cross section here involves hexagonal packing of the strands. And this distance is about 30 angstroms. You remember that the diameter of the DNA was about 20 angstroms, so this is pretty close packed DNA.
Well, I'm saying that if the total quantity of DNA is larger than that, it will aggregate into two different.
Well, in fact, there are experiments. Is Alexei Khoklov here? Yes? There are experiments with DNA a few times bigger than this, where you appear to get everything into a donut. So it's not as simple as what I'm saying, but yes, the problem I'm going to put on the table is, why do you not get any more than this amount of DNA if the system wants to collapse and it involves, for example, in this case, aggregation of many DNAs, you have Avogadro number of DNAs in solution, what stops the aggregation process? So I'll say a few words about that.
But the separate donuts are independent of one another.
Yes, yes. In fact, it's significant that the concentration is very low here. If you do this experiment at concentrations several orders of magnitude higher, you get all kinds of interesting condensed phases of DNA, which Rudy was talking about last week. The volume of the torus is little r squared big R, and it's certainly, you see the dimensions, small compared to what the volume was, say, before the condensation. So this is a compaction of DNA by as much as five orders of magnitude, and it turns out that this is the way that DNA is organized in biological cells whose purpose is to carry DNA as compactly as possible, like a sperm cell, or in the capsid of a virus. Basically, a virus is just DNA or RNA with a protein coat. And in those cells, the DNA is organized. It's packed at densities of almost 1 gram per cc. It's close packed DNA, and this is a leading candidate for the structure. So what I want to emphasize is that independent of what the condensing agent is, and therefore what the origin of the attraction between strands is, you get this quasi-universal behavior. It turns out it's fairly straightforward to understand what the shape of the torus will be, or more precisely, what the aspect ratio will be. And it turns out to involve a competition of the cohesive energy density and the bending energy associated with taking the DNA and bending it. After all, it's got a persistence length, and it's bending on a scale somewhat smaller than that. It can It's got the energy to do it because of the attractions between the strands. So, in the interest of time, I won't say anything further about this except to remark that the problem which I feel is not at all understood is not so much why do you get a bagel with a certain aspect ratio, big hole, little hole, rather than a racing bicycle tire, but rather why do you get a limit to the aggregation of the DNA? And generally, I mean, we're used to nucleation processes where you just win the battle against surface tension and then you have a bulk phase condensation. In complex fluids, there are many situations where you have microphase separation. So again, we're used to what you might think of as frustration effects, basically something that overwhelms the short-range attractions once the condensate builds up beyond a certain scale. And it's a problem we've worked on, and I don't believe we have the answer. I just want to mention one interesting twist on it. That is that we observe that if you try to build up a structure like this, which is a very natural one, to get a chain close to itself as soon as possible, and then to have as many nearest neighbors as possible, whatever the origin of the attraction is, you want the strands to be parallel and locally hexagonally packed. It's easy for me to take this chain, have it attract itself like this, starts winding around itself, and I could go on forever in the plane, build up a spiral with parallel strands close packed. However, I'd have two nearest neighbors, not six. Similarly, I could build a solenoid structure like this, where again, I have perfectly parallel strands. But again, I don't have enough nearest neighbors. Turns out that to have six nearest neighbors on average, every time you come around, you have to have a crossing of the strands. And we think of these as topologically unavoidable defects because of the very special geometry of the system. And then we struggle to show that these defects give rise to effectively a long-range repulsion which limits the condensation. However, it's quite likely that there are non-pairwise additive many-body electrostatic interactions that do that. Or it could be that there's some kinetic effect, some barrier that builds up once the thing condenses enough. It's an unsolved problem, but an important one.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what you meant by crossing there. Do you mean that if you're winding it up in that way, you have to thread the...
Here, I've come around here, and now I want to start doing better than two neighbors, so I have to cross over. And I have to do that every time on average to start getting local hexagonal packing.
I didn't feel aware in your line of argument, which you said may or may not be what's going on, you use pairwise potential. I mean, I thought that argument was that you have a line of defects.
I was mentioning that we believe that these topological defects can give rise to effectively long-range repulsions. But without defects, if you look carefully at the electrostatics of this system, as we'll see, you're taking the DNA is a highly charged object, and you're condensing it. So if one looks carefully at the nature of the self-energy of this thing, you have to do better than just look at a sum of strand-strand interactions.
You're saying many of the phenomena have nothing to do with these effects whatsoever.
That's right.
And it comes from somewhere else completely.
Yes.
So you aggregate the little one, you wouldn't have little crushing, right? Because you just pile
rings on rings. Right. But you're not going to have local hexagonal packing that way. You're just going to have these guys sitting on top of each other. And you'll have, in a sense, another kind of defect. I want to start talking about the model cell membranes now. This is what a phospholipid molecule looks like. Essentially, you have two long hydrocarbon tails, and then you have a hydrophilic head, something which is soluble in water. Cell membranes are made up of a large number of these phospholipids. By the way, the length of the molecule is on the order of 20, 25 angstroms, depending upon the chain lengths. You have many phospholipids in a cell membrane, and of course, you have thousands of all kinds of other molecules crucial for life, sugars, proteins, and so on. However, if you just take one phospholipid, throw it in water, because of the long hydrocarbon tails, it's essentially insoluble in water. The only way it can dissolve in water is by forming bilayer structures, which I think you've all seen these cartoons, and many of us have worked many years on the details of the structure of these semi-flexible chains organized this way in a molecular bilayer. So this dimension is about 50 angstroms, and the colored heads here just refer to the fact that there are charged lipids in membranes. So the simplest model for a cell membrane should include a mixture of neutral and charged lipids. Then you have both the effect of charge included and the effect of composition as an extra degree of freedom. These are essentially two-dimensional fluids, two-dimensional fluid mixtures. So what happens is that these become soluble in water by forming these structures. Then you see the water is protected from the hydrocarbon tails and the dipolar or ionic head groups are, if you like, solubilized by water. So what you get is something called a vesicle, which is just a bilayer of this kind that closes on itself. And so here I've just blown up part of this. You can get vesicles of all different sizes depending upon what lipid mixtures you take. But typically, one has vesicles on this size scale. And remember the scale for DNA. This is the persistence length of DNA. So there's a pretty rigid part of DNA, and then it goes along its way. Experiments done here at Santa Barbara in Sirius Safinia's group essentially involve making a bunch of model membranes by throwing neutral and charged lipids into water, making a dilute DNA solution, and mixing the two. So what would you expect happens? You have these long chains, and you have these little balls. Little compared to, for example, in many of their experiments, they use lambda-phage DNA, so the contour length here is more than 10 microns. So in fact, this behaves like a flexible coil with a radius of gyration huge compared to this. Originally, the idea was that because you take cationic lipids and the DNA is negatively charged, that the vesicle balls would just stick to the chain. You'd have beads on a necklace. It turns out that you get a complete reorganization of this self-assembled system. And I'll draw a cartoon of what you get when you mix these vesicles, these closed bilayers of neutral and charged lipid with DNA. And I think it's a beautiful example of another component of the systems we're interested in, namely that they are soft self-assembling systems. And the structures that evolve are very sensitive to composition, temperature, and so on. So what you get actually is a stack of bilayers . It's a multi-bilayer lamellar structure with the DNA intercalated in between. Very different from beads on a necklace. the charge density on the membranes is plus E over the area per lipid times the fraction of lipids that are charged. So this fraction is just number of charged lipids over the total number of lipids charged plus neutral. Obviously, it's between 0 and 1. But the area per lipid in these experiments is about 70 square angstroms. So you see that the positive surface charge density is of order 1 charge per 100 angstrom squared, which you recall, or I'll remind you, if you think about the charge density on the DNA, remember it was 1 charge per 1.7 angstroms, but that implied a surface charge density of 1 charge per this area, where this is of order 10 angstroms, and this turned out to be 1 charge per 100 angstrom squared. So this composition degree of freedom is very important because you can tune the mismatch between the high charge densities on these maker ions. If you take a solution, a bulk solution, where the number of lipid charges and the number of DNA charges is 1, then you get these sandwich assemblies forming. And keeping fixed the number of each kind of charge and therefore the ratio, you can just add neutral lipid and measure with X-rays this distance between the DNAs. And what you find is that the measured distance with an experimental error is the ratio of these charge densities. And you notice that this is exactly the distance between rods you'd need in order to be at the isoelectric point, where the charge per unit area in the layered assembly carried by the DNA is equal to the charge per unit area carried by the lipid. And in fact, you can see from the definitions of these charge densities that this is equal to some length divided by the fraction of charged lipid. And indeed, you see that as you add neutral lipid, changing the fraction m, the system adjusts to stay at the isoelectric point. And Steve?
So do you have to exclude salt, or does it stay out by itself?
No, there's salt. And when I talk about the isoelectric point, I'm comparing ion numbers for fixed charge, but we're always dealing with an electroneutral system. Okay? Even when you change this ratio from unity, after all, you can have a certain amount of lipid charge that isn't equal to the amount of DNA charge, and then the question is, what kind of complex will form? Will you have all of the DNA and lipid incorporated into one system like this, or will you have excess DNA or excess cationic lipid in order for this system to essentially stay at the isoelectric point? And the answer is that you can get significant deviations in the complex from the isoelectric point in terms of comparing these fixed charge densities. And Avi Ben-Shaul and his group have been working on this, and Avi will be talking about it, I think, next week. I want to mention it only as the first example now of what we might call overcharging, namely where you have conditions, say where you have more DNA charge than lipid charge, where the assemblies that form correspond to more DNA being in the complex than you would expect if you wanted to be strictly at the isoelectric points.
So you mean varying salt, you can deviate from the isoelectric
points? Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, again, this is a small part of the big phase diagram involving composition and salt space, and it requires certain species also of lipid and charged lipid. Sometimes you have very different complexes forming. It's just that these have been studied in gory detail, and they provide as nice an example of any system of what we might call overcharging. I should mention that one of the big motivations for studying these systems is as a gene therapy vehicle. If you have to get DNA targeted to cells that don't have the right DNA, you can incorporate it into viral DNA, and that's routinely done, but there are problems using viral carriers. So here's a way to deliver DNA to cells. You complex it with oppositely charged lipid. I will move on, unless there are specific questions here, to make certain that I put on the table my favorite example of overcharging. And then what I want to do with the remaining time is to tell you a little about Prossman-Boltzmann theory, and then suggest a way of thinking about overcharging in terms of counter-ion condensation.
Just a short question.
Yes.
To this picture. Why you draw only one line? Can it be not one layer of DNA, but a few layers?
You mean intercalated between?
Yeah.
It could be anything, but under the conditions of Sethenia's experiments, he determines with high-resolution X-ray what all these dimensions are. The thickness of the water layer, it turns out to be just enough to incorporate one layer of DNA. He gets the average distance between the DNAs.
But and in principle, yes? May have also some layering of DNA.
Again, this is a small part of composition salt space, so other structures will come in. There's another way, David, when you asked what's interesting about that glop, and I said, well, when it's condensed, as it is in sperm, in viral capsid situations, it's not that glop. Perhaps a more important context. Oh, no, no, but then it's many toroids.
So you have one.
Yes.
Same thing,
yes, yes. Maybe. It's one of the suggestions that's been made. What happens when you mix a highly charged chain with oppositely charged balls? That's what happens in chromosomal material, where you have what turns out to be a highly charged, positively charged octamer of proteins called histones. It's interesting that they don't assemble this way in the absence of DNA, but in the presence of DNA, they get wrapped a couple of times by DNA, and if you add special enzymes that cut DNA except where it's strongly bound, you find how much DNA was adsorbed, and that's the special number I mentioned, 146 base pairs. In lots of organisms, independent of where you are in the genome of the organism, the DNA wraps this number of times, suggesting that it isn't a base pair specific effect. The complexation of the DNA with the globule, with the aggregate of proteins. So again, it's intriguing, I think, to a physical scientist to ask, why does the DNA wrap around that number of times? And in fact, they're not spheres, they're short, squat, right circular cylinders, so they look more like this. But typically, the dimension here, the radius, is 50 angstroms. And that's very significant because you remember that the persistence length of DNA, whether it's plus or minus 30%, is essentially 10 times that. So the DNA is bending very tightly. And of course, it gets the energetic stabilization by doing so. But it's bending very tightly. The question is, why does it bend that much and that many times? So we can ask an embarrassingly simple electrostatics question. Now forget all the biological motivation. If I have a charged ball and an oppositely charged chain, how? And now even forget about counter ions and salt. So I have a purely energetic calculation to perform. How will the chain wrap around the ball? Will it adsorb enough to change the sign of the complex? And this is a problem that Phil Pinkus has been working on with a couple of people in his group, Edward Matiescu, who's here, I think, yes, and Klaus Jefferson. And what they did was to minimize the energy in a Monte Carlo calculation, minimize the energy of a flexible chain. So you have a chain with charge minus Ne, that's the number of monomers, length plus Na, A is the monomer size. You have a ball with charge plus Ze and diameter dA. And then you ask, what's the minimum energy configuration? Right now, no, I'm always talking about free energy. Right now I'm talking about energy because, I mean, sure, there's some, this is a non-zero temperature calculation, but it turns out that the entropy associated with the conformations of the chain is not important. It's a highly charged chain. It's essentially straight. And so it's just the fact that I don't have counter ions or salt here. I'm trying to see if we can get a straight answer to the question. How does the chain wrap around the ball? And you can get an interesting answer. It's not clear how general it is or what kinds of qualitative conclusions can be drawn. But they did a calculation where N was 100 and Z was 50. So if the chain adsorbs entirely, it's not just changing the sign, but giving you minus 50 for the net charge. It turns out that the chain significantly overcharges or over-neutralizes, overcompensates for the sign on the charge on the ball. Of course, it depends on the size of the ball. The bigger the ball, turns out the easier it is for the chain to overcompensate, because basically the chain can do a better job of staying away from itself once it's on the surface. It's enjoying the electrostatic attraction to the ball, but it wants to avoid itself as well as possible. Yes?
And there's no salt?
And there's no salt. I start with the very simplest question and answer. But there's also no simple qualitative explanation for what's going on, I think, other than that the chain for a given size ball will configure itself in such a way as to avoid itself as much as possible and still be on the surface of the ball. I'm sorry? There is a pattern that emerges. I won't attempt to draw it. Perhaps we can try in discussion afterwards. It's some distortion of a helical pattern. On a cylinder, you'd get a helical pattern for the chain avoiding itself. On this sphere, it's a little more complicated. But I think the cylinder is a special case. But I think the important point is that I don't think there's a simple physical interpretation that allows you to make any general remarks about whether the chain adsorbs enough to partially compensate for the sign or to reverse it. This is a perfectly flexible chain. Obviously, if you make it a persistent chain, it'll be harder for it to do the job of compensating for charge.
This number of base pairs here, I mean, It depends on the radius of the histone. It's not universal in that sense.
Right. No, but histones are universal. Whereas the biologists say histones are well conserved, their structure. That is significant that the histone is always the same.
You will have larger objects.
But there is room, obviously, for the DNA to wrap around less. Why doesn't it? Why does it wrap around enough, by the way, to carry a charge that more than compensates for the total charge on the histone?
That could be an explanation, of course. Because
there is surely an explanation. The question is, what is it? Although that's a longer discussion one could have. I want to be careful not to go too long. And I have to write down the Poisson-Boltzmann equation. Because I told you it's the mean field theory for electrolyte solutions and microions in solution. I'll illustrate the theory for the textbook example of a single planar surface. It's, say, negatively charged. The charge density, the bar means its number of charges per unit area, is 1 over the sigma. I'm going to talk first about the case where there's no salt in solution, only the counterions. And then we'll add salt and see what happens. So how do we characterize the solution? The surface is totally defined by the surface charge density. It's fixed, uniform. We have some dielectric constant. We're not worrying about the structure of water. It's another very interesting set of problems. And because we're looking at a system of thermal equilibrium, we need to know what the temperature is. It turns out, therefore, that and there's just one way these guys come in along with the charge on the counterions. Keep it simple, make it one. And that's to a length, the Biram length, which is E squared over epsilon kT. And it's the distance at which two fundamental charges repel each other with the thermal energy. Okay. Now, Poisson's equation relates the electrostatic potential. These are my units here. Well, lots of people. Local charge density. And now, because of the symmetry here, and that's why this is such a nice example for illustration, this depends only on Z, and the potential depends only on Z, and it's the charge times the number density of counterions. And the mean field approximation is introduced, I'm being very quick and dirty with this, by writing this in the form of a Boltzmann factor where the energy is just the local potential. And then you get the nonlinear equation for the potential. And this is the famous Poisson-Boltzmann equation. And it very often gets linearized, and we talk about the bifocal theory. But for this situation, it doesn't need to be linearized. And it turns out, if you avoid linearizing, you get a very interesting phenomenon called many things, counterion condensation, charge renormalization. For this case, the density, instead of being exponential, is algebraic, and I'm not going to bother with factors of pi. It's basically 1 over the Biram length times C plus some length squared. This length is, again, apart from numerical factors of order unity, it's 1 over the charge density on the surface times the Biram length. And this is the GUI-Chapman length, or Chapman length. It's the electrical double layer thickness, if you like. There are many physical interpretations you can give to it. It's the distance at which the potential energy due to the surface is kT. It's the distance you have to go to get half the counter ions. And for typical high surface charge densities, like one charge per 100 angstrom squared, it turns out if you make a very simple estimate of what the number density at the surface is, it'll go roughly as 1 over sigma bar, that's sigma bar over LC, this turns out to be many molar. You have a very high concentration of counter ions at the surface. And that's why very often salt in bulk solution is irrelevant to what's happening near the surface of a highly charged object.
What is the condition for this very simple mean field theory to be valid? I mean, condition.
Yeah, and it's yeah,
to yeah. It's not so easy to.
It isn't, and someone wants to disagree, they have to give a simple answer. I don't think there's a simple answer to your question.
Has yeah. Come in somehow to talk about that, and it's.
Yeah.
I'm
presenting it in a very quick and dirty way.
Is it known?
A lot is known about it. We're going to hear tomorrow from Roland Schillander about going beyond Poisson-Boltzmann theory and what the correlation are, the correlations are that are left out of this theory and when they're important.
Thus, you can't find a simple condition within the quantities you have on the board to say this is what I need to satisfy for this theory.
I can only tell you that if surfaces aren't too highly charged, and if the valency of the ions is low enough, the mean field theory can work well. But then it depends, are you asking about the mean field prediction of interaction between like charge maker ions or opposite charge? And then the answer has to be qualified. I argued I had to say something about the Poisson-Boltzmann theory. I have to say something about the linearized Poisson-Boltzmann theory, and we'll do it by adding salt to the solution so that let's say we have salt with we have this system in equilibrium with a reservoir of salt where the bulk salt concentration is NB. Then we have positive mobile ions, and we have negative ones. Poisson-Boltzmann equation assumes this form, but you know that this is minus twice sinh of negative 1 over kT, and you know that when the potential is small enough, this can be approximated by its argument, and then you find the famous Debye-Hückel equation, or linearized Poisson-Boltzmann theory. I'm going to multiply both sides by beta e to make potentials dimensionless, so I will get beta e squared and b over epsilon. And then I think it's just AP. So this is the dimensionless potential. And here you have, this turns out is the Biram length. And this has dimensions of 1 over length squared, because you have gradient squared. And indeed, this is kappa squared, or 1 over the square of the Debye length. And now we're in a position, I will argue, to talk about the idea of counter-ion condensation and charge renormalization or compensation of surface charge. Again, I'm going to do it in a quick and dirty way. It's easy to solve this equation. And you find, since it's linear, you find phi, except for factors of pi and so on, the surface charge density times this product of lengths. So this is the solution for the potential, very familiar looking, when you can linearize the mean field theory. Now suppose we ask, as has been asked in a very interesting and systematic way, how can you fit this simple solution to the linearized theory to the actual nonlinear Poisson-Boltzmann theory? What charge density would you need to associate with the planar surface in order that the actual potential far from the surface looked like the Debye-Huckel one? If you do the nonlinear Poisson-Boltzmann calculations and answer that question, you find a very interesting universal result for the effective charge density, or the renormalized, compensated charge density on the surface due to effects included in the nonlinear theory. It's a kind of screening that goes beyond the linear Debye-Huckel screening. It's the fact that counterions hang around the surface in a certain way so as to neutralize the charge on the surface to the point where the potential far away is weak enough so that it looks like the Debye-Huckel form. So if we ask, what's the effective charge density as a function of the actual charge density, what you find, and going to make this dimensionless, dividing by, see, it's natural to introduce a unit of charge density, which is 1 over the product of the Debye length and the Beuren length. So if you do that, and this is work that I just learned about last week, Roland Schallender told me about it, so it goes back to the 80s, and it's associated with several people, I'm sure. Okay, important people who are here. At large surface charge densities, the far field becomes independent of the actual charge on the surface. And a simple interpretation is that you have enough condensation of counterions at the surface so that the effective or compensated charge density is significantly lower. So, going to interpret this another way, and that is that at all surface charge densities, however small, there is already charge compensation or counterion condensation in this case, so that the effective charge density that determines the far field is less than the actual one. Please. Yes.
Why are you interested in finding out whether the how well the linear approximation works in the model?
I'm not.
It can be integrated in the computer. The nonlinear equation, that's what I particularly wanted in the nonlinear.
That's right. In fact, it's not trivial to solve numerically the nonlinear Poisson-Boltzmann equation for interesting geometries. Okay? You have to use a lot of tricks. It's just being done for interesting geometries. We're having a session this afternoon where we're talking about two papers that just came out where it's solved for spheres or cylinders confined between two plates. It's a non-trivial calculation. Okay, yeah, but I would say the real answer to your question is that one wants a simple physical picture for the difference between the linear and nonlinear theories. And I will argue it's important to have that simple physical picture before you go beyond even remember, the nonlinear theory is a mean field theory. It doesn't include ion correlation effects. So to begin to understand when you need to look at those correlation effects, I think this is an important picture.
I'll just take the linear theory as a model. The nonlinear theory is also an approximation and one doesn't know.
Except that it, again, in answer to your earlier question, it works very well in many interesting, physically interesting situations. And another interpretation of what I'm saying is that the linear theory works well if you work with a renormalized charge density. So, I want to draw a picture like this for a different geometry. Sigma star is the actual charge density on the surface you'd need in order for the linearized theory to give you the result in agreement with the nonlinear theory for a bare fixed charge density sigma. It tells you the degree of charge renormalization. The fact that sigma star always lies below this line tells you that there is charge renormalization. Remember, sigma star is defined by comparing the linear and nonlinear theories. And since we have a simple solution for the linear theory, where the potential is simply proportional to the... With higher charge density, yes. I just erased it, but the solution to the linear theory, the potential is proportional to the charge density. So the potential is getting bigger with higher charge density, and it's not surprising that deviations from the linear theory become more important. But I want to stress that no matter how low the surface charge density is, there's always a surface charge renormalization, whereas if I do the same calculation for a sphere maker ion, and ask what does the charge on the sphere Z star have to be so that the exponential decaying potential that's appropriate for the linear theory agrees with the actual nonlinear solution for this charge Z, what you find is that there is no charge renormalization because, in fact, the counter ions don't hang around. And this has to do with the fundamental difference in dimensionalities between a plate and a sphere and the nature of the Coulomb potential in these different dimensions. Here, the potential is linear in distance. Here, it's 1 over distance. And for intermediate dimensionality, the rod, it's logarithmic. And it turns out, let me draw the same picture here. Here I want to know, remember we have a linear charge density lambda, or one charge per distance b, and I will write that in units of 1 over the Biram length. Okay. What does this look like as a function of bare line charge density? And what you find there is this. Remember what lambda prime is. Lambda bar is 1 over b. This turns out to be the Biram length over the distance between charges, and that's usually written c, and that's a famous parameter associated with Manning and Ozawa. Something critical happens at this value of the fixed charge density in the case of intermediate dimension, a rod, and that is that until that point, the effective charge density is the bare one. It starts getting renormalized here. Notice in all cases where you get renormalization, there's a saturation effect. Basically, the counter ions condense enough so that they put a limit on what the effective charge density is. In fact, in all three cases, I am. And now that reminds me to mention the interesting follow-up here. Of course, if I let there be planes interacting with the single surface, other balls, other rods, then I revise this. But this accentuates the dimensionality effect. You never have an isolated colloidal charge sphere. You always have it at some non-zero volume fraction. And then what you find is something like this, where you find that there is some threshold for fixed charge density that's required before you see counterion condensation and charge renormalization. It's special that in the case of spheres, that threshold depends on concentration. It requires a non-zero concentration of microions for there to be charge renormalization, whereas in the other cases, the effect of non-zero density of microions is just to change quantitatively what's going on. So there's a paper in 1984 by Shlomo Alexander, Phil Pinkus, Paul Chaikin, Dan Hone, George Morales. Who else? The question is, who wasn't on it? Yeah, remember that. Okay. I better finish up with a few qualitative remarks. I want to make certain I get to the punchline. I hope it follows naturally from what I'm saying. What one can do with the single ball and chain problem is to add counterions and add salt. And then one is looking at a minimum free energy that describes how the oppositely charged microions complex. And the question is, do you get overcharging? What we've done is to use these ideas, these counterion condensation and charge renormalization ideas, to account for the effect of counterion entropy. Basically, we show that the chain will over-neutralize the ball, because by converting highly charged chain, where you have highly condensed counterions, to chain adsorbed on a now weakly charged ball, which can't hold on to its counterions, there's an entropic driving force for this overcharging. Then I want to mention, we also worry about the effect of bending energy of the chain and so on. But I want to mention several problems now that I think are intimately related to these questions. David Andelman talked last week about what happens when you stick a charged planar surface into not a simple salt solution, but a polyelectrolyte solution. And he looked on a Poisson-Boltzmann level at the nature and extent of adsorption of polymer on the oppositely charged surface. And one finds there that the charge on the surface is overcompensated, which means outside the adsorbed polymer layer, you actually have a field whose sign is different from what it was before you had adsorption of the polymer. And yet, one is working at the Poisson-Boltzmann level. If you were to ask, can you get charge overcompensation by sticking a highly charged surface into a simple salt solution, say a 1-1 salt, the answer is, well, you get compensation, but not overcompensation. Notice you don't change the sign here. You just saturate the effective charge. Roland Schellender and others have gone beyond Marcelo Lozada, who's here. He's not here? Okay. Have gone beyond the Poisson-Boltzmann theory. In fact, many people coming from a simpler liquids point of view have asked, how do you put correlations between the mobile ions into the theory? And then it turns out that you deviate from this universal behavior. You can have more or less compensation depending upon details of the valency of the salt, the ionic radii of the salt, that's not contained in the simple mean field theory, and of course, when you go to divalent and higher charge counter and co-ions, it turns out that you see something like this. You see overcompensation. That's equivalent to finding that the electric field has a different sign, because the counter ions have more than compensated for the surface charge. Well, in fact, you see it in simulation using what's called a primitive model, charged hard spheres. You see it in integral equation approaches where you systematically go beyond the mean field theory. So there are many levels of theory that give you this effect. And that's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe people have simpler perturbative arguments, but
using an extremis is less important.
Starting at that point.
Mm-hmm. So what I'm suggesting as I stop is that I think it's important to look at the connections between these well-studied but largely orthogonal questions and problems, namely the overcharging effect when you have a long polymer and an oppositely charged maker ion, and the overcompensation effect associated with bulk surfaces and bulk solution. I think the key thing for getting overcompensation and overcharging, rather than just compensation and reducing the effective charge, is that you have something that allows the screening ions to be correlated. And you do it explicitly when you go beyond the mean field theory, but you can, within the Poisson-Boltzmann theory, for polyelectrolytes, get this kind of overcharging, I think, just because of the connectivity of the chain, which is obviously a very special kind of correlation between the charged ions. So I think I'll stop there. I hope there are more questions.
Can I have a question? You had at the beginning this very sexy result about the size of your donut. Yeah? And DNA is two-stranded molecule. And for instance, we found in our theory that then the interaction between two DNA will depend on the orientation of them. And for favorable orientation, you will gain a lot of energy. Now, if you will try to work with the one rope packing that way, so you will lose, of course, the energy because you won't be able to adjust them.
There's a lot of disruption of what's called the BDNA structure here. Yeah. We start and end with
and
this.
Of course, you will lose the energy on distortion of defects, and finally you end up with a finite size. Now, if that type of interpretation is okay, then for one-stranded molecule, where you don't have this symmetry important things of adjustment, of angular adjustment, you'll have very long donuts, or very thick donuts. Do you have any facts of that kind?
No, I haven't looked at the literature on single-strand condensation, but I'm glad you asked the question because Monsieur Safino always gets upset when I say DNA is really just like any other molecule. Of course, it's most special in all the obvious ways, but what's interesting, I think, to a physical scientist is always to ask the question, whatever DNA is doing that's spectacular, when it doesn't depend on details like base pair sequence and so on, shouldn't it be a general phenomenon? And I think these donuts should be seen in any charged persistent chain. It's just that people don't study in detail the structure of condensates when they're not working with DNA. But one should look systematically. These sandwich structures I showed you, they're already being investigated for non-DNA polymers. There's nothing particular about DNA. You just need the charge density being high and the persistence.
I'd like to get back to the point where they did the concerning the entropy. For example, you're doing all your models that the DNA is approximated by basically a single strand, single polymer. Now, certainly it costs energy for the two helix to separate and close, but then you gain, for very long DNA chain, you gain a huge entropy factor, don't you? So
how does their separating and closing help?
In this model, they have basically a fixed distance between them.
Yes.
But suppose they open, start younger independently, and then close.
Yeah. That doesn't happen spontaneously. This is a strongly stabilized structure. So I'm not sure what the context is for you.
When you talk about them in a sort of embedded in some salt and so on, this does not...
These are highly stable structures. I'm sorry?
Luckily,
yes. So you need... Yes, and you need very special disruptive molecules, very special proteins, enzymes, to do the kinds of things you're talking about, to do just about anything to the DNA.
And this is explained by a simple entropy estimate. Mm-hmm. This is blown out. When you put in the electrostatics and whatever entropy is in
the... Are you asking what accounts for the energetic stability of the double helix?
Energetic and entropic stability.
It's mostly hydrogen bonding and pairing the bases and stacking them. Well, everything's involved, but generally, in order to disrupt the double helix, you have to disrupt the hydrogen bonding that pairs the bases. There's a base from each chain, and then that stacks them to give the double helix. If you want to, you know, you can untwist this into a ladder. You still have double-stranded DNA, but it's not helical, and the base pairs are much farther apart, and you've broken, in quotes, the hydrogen bonds between the bases.
Sorry to get back to biology, but I'm not sure. So you said that there was some chromosomal role of this winding around?
Yeah.
Biological.
The chromatin, chromosomal material, is essentially an octamer of globular positively charged proteins, and of course the other proteins doing little jobs, but basically the DNA wraps a couple of times around each, goes on average 100 base pairs before it wraps again, and you want DNA condensed in chromosomal material, but not too condensed, because you want to be able to read it. And then apropos your question, you have very special enzymes that come along and systematically disrupt the DNA. Absolutely, yes. And the biologists with incredible detail have worked out scenarios for how a large number of enzymes work to...
The positioning of histones is correlated with the actual information content.
It is, so I was being heavy-handed when I said independent of base pair sequencing. The fact is that you always have this 146 base pairs, but there are special positions in a genome for these things.
The DNA that goes around histone junk?
No.
It's 146.
No. Different sequences, but...
Between or off precious rate?
I can't give authoritative answers, I'm sorry. Maybe somebody can who's here. It is, of course, very important.
What do they gain being on histones? Because you said histones of 50 on
the radius. Oh, but there's...
And we know that the persistence length is 500.
Yeah, but
so
this...
they must lose a lot of mechanical energy.
Yes, but...
what do they gain? What is it?
Electrostatic stabilization energy.
Yeah, it's interaction.
These histones have charges of about 250.
It's mainly interaction with histones, not with each other. On a
histone. Oh, no, again, they're trying to avoid themselves, whatever. Yes. I'm sorry? Yes, and it's important. Yes, the diameter of the DNA is tens of angstroms. That's one more important detail.
What was the reason of the Havelock histone not to fight against the persistent length? Could you guess about it?
Thank you.
Well, thank you.